2009, the markets declined more than 50%. The market declined 50% during the 1907 rich man's panic. The time cycle repeats. The price drop percentages repeat. The further back we go in terms of cycles, and the longer these cycles are, the more significant they become. So let's look at the long-range cycles weaving together and coming to a head in 2017. It starts in 1837. That was 180 years ago. If you're wondering why I chose the number 180, it's because 10, 20, 30, and 60-year cycles are of utmost importance in financial markets. 180 years is a multiple of all of these, as well as the 90 and 45-year cycles that we have already talked about. In 1837, there was a crash and subsequent recession that led into a depression. The roots of that crisis went all the way back to 1819, if not earlier. Andrew Jackson, Old Hickory, had been vehemently opposed to the chartering of the Second Bank of the United States. A libertarian Jacksonian movement sprung up, favoring free trade, and very much against the way the bank had been operating. In 1832, the bank's charter came up for renewal. Jackson was president and did everything in his power to ensure that the bank didn't continue. One of his reasons was that he believed that powerful outsiders, like the Rothschilds, controlled the bank. He ran for re-election under the slogan, Jackson and No Bank. He wanted to regain control of the American monetary system to benefit the people of the land. As soon as he was re-elected, he withdrew government funds and placed them into state banks, with the intention of putting monies under democratic control. This was where the plan backfired. These regional banks didn't regulate credit correctly. In fact, they abused their lending powers by not maintaining specie, i.e. money in the form of coins, rather than notes, creating yet another bubble. Loan money was very cheap. Chicago and the surrounding regions were the main focus for development. Both railroads and canals were being built at a great pace, so that the Midwest could be connected to the Great Lakes and all the way to the Atlantic by way of the St. Lawrence Seaway. Property prices rose exponentially, and what followed was a huge land speculation crisis. In 1836, the U.S. Treasury Department was forced to issue a circular announcing that only gold and silver pieces would be redeemable on payment for public lands. This precipitated the Panic of 1837, which began on May 10th. The ensuing depression lasted 6 years, with more than 600 banks closing. This was exacerbated by a rapid decline in commodity prices. Meanwhile, in Europe in 1837, Great Britain had also rapidly reined in lending. The consequences were severe. Confidence fell in both the currency system and the economy. By the early 1840s, American stock prices were down 74% from the highs of the previous decade. A serious depression had kicked in. More than 850 American banks failed, and Chicago's overnight boom turned into a 90% plus collapse in real estate prices. This long-term scenario is similar to where we find ourselves in 2017. 2017. Thus far, we've discussed the 10-year cycle and the 180-year cycle as being relevant to 2017. And we've looked at the historical importance of the 144-year cycle. When we apply this latter cycle to 2017, it takes us back to 1873. That fateful year saw multiple panics break out around the globe. In Europe, crisis broke out in Vienna and spread across the continent. The United States had been in a Reconstruction-era bubble period. Silver was demonetized. The Jay Cook crisis took place. This was when the man widely recognized as America's first major investment banker was forced into bankruptcy as the railroad expansion began to falter yet again, and he was unable to sell the bonds it held in the Northern Pacific Railway. Jay Cook and Company declared bankruptcy on September 18, 1873. 2 days later, on September 20th, the New York Stock Exchange closed for 10 days. This panic developed into a depression that lasted 6 years in the United States. America readopted the gold standard in 1879, boosting the recovery. In Europe, the effects were far greater. The railroad expansion was vast, as the various countries merged their tracks together. This bubble burst with gusto. Britain saw worsening economic conditions that lasted nearly 20 years. This was termed the Great Depression, not to be confused with the worldwide 1930s event that goes by the same name. Note that if we add about 60 years to the 1873 crisis, we arrive at the Great Depression of the 1930s. This is an example of the Kondratiev wave in action. Furthermore, if we add 100 years to 1873, we arrive at the Arab oil crisis in 1973 to 1974, which, in turn, spawned a major recession in both Britain and America. Forgive me if I seem a little repetitive in detailing some of these years, but I'm sure you see why it's important. The UK went on what was known as the three-day week, during which electricity was guaranteed for only 3 working days in the week. TV stations were made to stop transmitting at an early hour. This was because most power was generated by coal-fired power stations, and it was scarce. British miners went on strike, heightening the issues of the oil crisis. This was the flavour of the mid-1970s. About 100 years earlier, the United States had been plagued by coal miner strikes. Returning to the 1930s depression and adding half the populist movement cycle, or 40 to 42 years, also takes us to 1974. This is how precise the timing of economic events can be. You'll recall how the 100-year cycle helped us forecast the 2007-2008 global financial crisis. So let's consider its relevance to 2017. Heading back to 1917, the globe was in the penultimate year of the First World War. While wars are generally good for economic production due to the high demand for arms, none of the parties had anticipated that this war would go on for so long. A major high came into place across the stock markets in autumn 1917, and we saw a 45% correction that lasted a year. The next cycle that's coming into play is that of 90 years. This takes us back to 1927. During that time, we saw a somewhat smaller pullback in what was the biggest and most aggressive bull market to date. This was due mainly to the last part of the Florida land speculation boom, which just ran out of steam. There had been much fraudulent activity, too. Heading back 60 years takes us to 1957. The US market sold off steadily as industrial production peaked. The mass market for automobiles reached saturation level. There was a series of strikes and labor relations issues. Some of you will recall the 1987 crash. At the time, it was seen as the sharpest financial meltdown ever, as it occurred largely in 2 weeks, and much of that in one day. Well, 2017 is exactly 30 years on from this date. Back then, the market sold off 37%. The market dropped 23% on Black Monday, October 19th, alone. Some saw it as a technical correction, and some also make the case that derivatives trading and computer system trading, both of which were in relative infancy compared with the present day, were major factors in this event. What's interesting, though, is that the UK, which was badly hit by the crash, was experiencing severe weather. A hurricane had swept through the south of England. England is rarely hit by hurricanes. It had rained heavily before the hurricane, so the ground was sodden. Many trees fell, bringing down huge numbers of power and telephone lines with them. Communications were greatly hampered, and all travel stopped. I recall being on my way to the airport to catch a flight that evening. It was otherworldly. There were no other cars out on the road. A solitary policeman took refuge in the doorway of a shop. My car was blown around by the crazy wind. I was within 3 miles of the airport when the road I was on became completely blocked by a massive tree. I had no choice but to turn around and try an alternate route. At this point, I wondered if we'd make the flight. I backtracked half a mile before my path was blocked again by another tree that had come down just minutes earlier. I was trapped, and trees that had stood for hundreds of years were coming down left, right, and center. I survived the night in the car, trapped amid a falling forest. This was well before the days of mobile phones. I tell you this story for two reasons. First, on a practical level, due to the infrastructure damage, very few people went into their offices the day after the storm. This meant that the volume of trading was very light on the Friday before the crash. This may have allowed the computer models to take over. Second, extreme market behavior often coincides with extreme weather conditions. Just some food for thought. The 30-year cycle is a strong one, and we must keep it on our radar. If we were to look back 20 years, 1997 saw the Asian financial crisis, which led to a temporary suspension of trading on the New York Stock Exchange. During July 1997, the Thai government was unable to support its currency due to lack of reserves, and the baht collapsed. This exacerbated the economic conditions in Thailand, which was already pretty much bankrupt and unable to meet her financial obligations. Indonesia and South Korea were deeply affected, as were most of the Southeast Asian nations. This event was so severe, it brought a temporary break to the massive tech rally of the late 1990s. The 20-year cycle is also important. Don't be surprised if we see a crisis with origins in the Far East in late 2017. Bringing it all together. That's a lot of information to process, so let's summarize. 2017 is a year ending in 7. It's 180 years from the 1837 panic, which had its roots in Chicago. That's a big one. A massive depression from 1835 to 1843, followed by a relapse into 1857. It's 144 years from the 1873 Jay Cooke Investment Bank collapse and the Great Railroad Panic and Depression. The 100-year supercycle runs from 1917 to 2017. In late 1917, it resulted in a hefty sell-off. The 90-year cycle takes us back to a pause in the rampant bull market of the Roaring Twenties. The 60-year cycle, from 1957, saw a significant sell-off as automobile manufacturing peaked, and as it appears to be occurring in 2017, as Harry's demographic trends would also have forecast. The 30-year cycle takes us all the way back to the 1987 crash. The 20-year cycle takes us back to the Asian financial crisis from 1997 into 2002. And the 10-year cycle takes us back to the global financial crisis after 2007. I get chills every time I hear that summary, don't you? As you can see, the longer-term cycles have a great economic impact. History clearly repeats itself in the financial markets. But that list isn't all of it. There's a smaller cycle of 18.6 years, the business cycle that impacts America. It peaked around May 2017 and has more to do with real estate. As you can see, 2017 is a critical year and has a huge set of cycle culminations, especially from August forward. That makes this book now critical to your survival and prosperity, not just through 2017 and the aftermath, but through the other challenging years ahead. 2019. The year 2019 sees the reappearance of one of the biggest cycles in a long time, a 90-year cycle from the 1929 crash and a 45-year cycle from the 1974 low. Hence, this is likely to be one of the worst years coming up, along with late 2017. It will also be 100 years on from the 1919 oil panic. These are major. September 3, 1929, saw the final top of a bull market that lasted more than 8 years. The 1920s saw a post-war boom. Automobile ownership was rising, and technology was flourishing, especially the radio. RCA was one of the glamour stocks of the decade. Aviation was set to grow and challenge the railroads. As I've already said, skyscrapers were springing up in New York and Chicago. Silent movies would soon become a thing of the past, following the release of the first talkie, The Jazz Singer, in October 1927. By the beginning of 1929, pretty much everybody was playing the stock market. Everyone was an expert on stock picking. Bucket shops had sprung up, making it easy to invest on margin. But people were ignorant of the past. They didn't know about the 72-year cycle that was about to hit them. We've already talked about 1857. They hadn't noticed the 10-year cycle from 1919 or the 20-year cycle from 1909, not to mention the 90-year cycle going back to the Depression of 1839. There were so many cycles coming together, it defies belief. Guess what? The year 2019 ties into the majority of cycles that triggered the 1929 crash. So be alert for a major stock market event in 2019, especially the latter part of the year. It's also important to note that 2019 is 45 years on from the Arab oil crisis and the major inflationary recession that took place then. The 30-year cycle from 1989 marks a critical point in the history of Japanese finance. The Nikkei 225 reached an all-time high in December of that year. This high has never been beaten, and the Japanese recession since is well documented. I would expect gold to come under the spotlight during 2019 and into 2020 as well, likely a long-term bottom and a huge investment opportunity. But again, we'll see when these cycles unfold more predictably. Harry is looking for a possible major bottom in emerging countries and commodity prices by late 2019 or early 2020. Back in 1869, 150 years ago, President Ulysses S. Grant decided to sell gold reserves to pay off debts arising from the Civil War. James Fisk and Jay Gould had a ploy to corner the gold market. Their operations led to a significant rise in the price of gold. However, on September 24, 1869, Black Friday, their corner collapsed, and the price of gold came crashing down. During the Depression of 1884, huge amounts of gold left America and flowed to Europe. This was three cycles of 45 years back from 2019. 45 years ago, in 1974, gold peaked in response to global geopolitical instability. Heading back to 1979, on two 20-year cycles, or four decennial cycles, we see that the Hunt brothers attempted to corner the silver market, which went on to peak in March 1980. Gold rose in tandem, making a major high. They were thwarted in the final stages by a sudden change in margining requirements, and again the price of the metals came crashing down. All of this is to tell you that 2019 has all the makings for potentially large moves in the precious metals markets at the same time as a major stock market crisis. 2020. The most important cycle that comes out in 2020 is a 300-year one. While you may not think it's relevant to go so far back, it's perhaps the most important boom and bust that has ever taken place. So we can learn a lot from it to secure our own financial future. I'm talking, of course, about the 1720 Mississippi land bubble in France and the South Sea bubble in England. And John Law, the first central banker in France, funded the country's growing debts after wars with England through a totally artificial bubble in Louisiana swampland, selling acreage to high-end investors at low government-induced interest rates. Near free money. Easy credit, and endless potential in swampland. A perfect bubble. And it was the first and most extreme in stock history. Sound familiar to today, with central banks goosing up everything with endless money printing and near zero interest rates and guarantees of everything from bank accounts to mortgages? England had a similar strategy of selling off its ownership in the South Sea Company to pay off its debts, and the greatest stock sell-off in history ensued in both stock market bubbles, from 1720 into 1722, the first great stock bubble, following the equally dramatic tulip bubble in futures in the early 1600s. And it illustrates how human behaviour never changes. But there are also other cycles. 10 years back from 2020 takes us to 2010. Many of the commodity markets had a second peak that year. This means that gold and silver could see big moves. The 72-year cycle saw a commodity price peak at the end of World War II. 20 years back from 2020 takes us to the end of the tech stock boom on the Nasdaq. What I find particularly fascinating when I study our crisis matrix is that all of the other cycles we look at to ascertain what will happen in 2020 show either depression or recession. This is a direct consequence of the events of the previous few years. Both 1840 and 1870 had recessions, as did 1920 and 1930. The same is true for 1960 and 1970. This is very telling. If we are indeed to see a major economic downturn in 2020, that would validate the notion that we're about to see some major financial challenges during the years 2017 to 2019.
Part 3. How to profit from the greatest revolution and financial crisis since the late 1700s. Chapter 15. The Two Safe Havens in Winter. This is about how well you want to sleep at night, while still being in the game to make money. Harry Dent. Probably the most important rule in the entire world of money is, don't fight the Fed. It doesn't matter if you're Bill Gates or Homer Simpson. Resistance is futile. The Fed will always have more money than you because they're the guys who print it. So betting against the Fed is a bad, bad idea. Many a trader has tried it. At some point, they probably weren't solvent enough to try it again. I, too, have been humbled by them, predicting that this bubble could peak and then watching as central banks just keep goosing it up higher. They're sowing the seeds of their own death, but I'm still taking it in the nuts. These days, don't fight the Fed sounds a little provincial. It's a big world out there, and the Fed isn't the only central bank in town. The European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan, and the People's Bank of China all carry similar clout on their own home turf. You fight them at your own peril. And you certainly don't want to buy what they're selling. The U.S. Federal Reserve has been less aggressive in stimulus policies than these other central banks lately, making us the best house in a bad neighborhood. And that's why the dollar has been one of the safe havens, as I'll discuss ahead. Yet many foolish investors are buying what these central banks are selling, and it's setting up a potential fixed income trade of the decade. I wrote about the possibility of this opportunity in my last book, The Sale of a Lifetime. It's still in the cards, and one of only two safe havens you'll have in the financial crises and revolution ahead. As I said in Chapter 13, there are many triggers for the next global crash and financial crisis. What I didn't mention was the stealth trigger gathering steam right under unsuspecting noses. The devastation of emerging markets. Now understand that emerging markets will be our next boomers, as I'll explain in Chapter 16. But first, they've got a problem in their leading nation. After decades of China overbuilding everything and sucking up the world's commodities like an industrial-strength vacuum to keep up the illusion of insatiable growth and remain the export machine to the world, any slowdown there puts the hurt on emerging markets. Their exports of commodities and everything else suffer, which zings the profitability of their companies and takes a wrecking ball to their stock markets and economies. Fewer exports means less capital coming in and slower growth of foreign exchange reserves, from trade surpluses. There's no doubt that China's gears are no longer spinning at the rate they once did, and with each report showing slowing out of China, emerging markets take a punch to the gut, as do commodities. There's also the problem of their currencies. They're unstable due to their export and economic weakness. When their currencies take a dive, they sell their foreign exchange reserves, FX, to defend themselves. Because 62% of foreign central bank reserves are held in U.S. dollar securities, and the dollar has been the world's strongest major currency, it makes sense to unload dollars the most. And that means U.S. Treasury and agency securities are perpetually on the chopping block. That's where the fixed income trade of the decade opportunity potentially lies. The fixed income trade of the decade. Selling treasury bonds puts downward pressure on their price and upward pressure on yields. As low as U.S. treasuries have gotten, 1.36% on the 10-year treasury note in January 2014, their yields can go still lower for many reasons, but mostly because of the deeper trends toward deflation in this economic winter season, when QE and fiscal stimulus plans finally fail. During 2016, foreign central banks went from buying as much as $231 billion a year to selling $397 billion, a $628 billion shift. Add to that the fact that the Fed stopped buying $1 trillion worth of U.S. treasuries per year, and our government bond market shrank by $1.6 trillion in the past 2 years. Under these circumstances, treasury rates are likely to rise initially, despite economic slowing and the deflationary trends at play around the globe right now. All it takes for bond prices to crash and bond yields to rise sharply is a temporary liquidity crisis. While debt held at the Fed on behalf of foreign central banks is once again high, at the time of this writing, any bump in the road could reverse this situation once again. When that happens, you'll be able to enter the fixed income trade of the decade. Get in when bond prices are at their lowest, and you'll secure the highest, safest yields available. This is like getting that car you've always wanted, but couldn't afford because the price just wasn't right. Really, we couldn't ask for a more perfect setup than the one likely to open up before us just ahead. A word of warning, though. I'm not saying to buy treasuries right now. It's too early. But I am saying you should get ready to back the truck up, because when the time comes, you're going to want to load it up and then come back for more. When the time is right, corporate AAA bonds will also be seen as a safe haven and will appreciate in value, while junk bonds will suffer major defaults. Why U.S. Treasuries and corporate AAAs could soon be dirt cheap. Emerging countries are desperate to keep their currencies stable. After all, a weaker currency makes their exports more competitive. The problem is that currencies aren't valued in isolation. They're valued as compared with another currency. Thus, a weak yuan, or peso, or rand invariably means a strong U.S. dollar. And that's actually bad for these guys. After all, commodities are priced in dollars, so a strong dollar means weak commodity prices, which erodes the value of exports. Besides that, a declining currency causes inflation to rise sharply, due to rising import costs. And that's a problem for emerging countries, including the big boys of China, Brazil, and India. Inflation also raises their domestic and government borrowing costs by causing bond yields to rise. And since they've borrowed like crazy since 2008, they must protect themselves from being squashed like a bug by their ballooning debt. So emerging country central banks find themselves forced into selling treasuries, an action that could accelerate in the months ahead. But know this. This potential spike in rates leading to the fixed income trade of the decade is a relatively short-term play. I don't expect it to last any longer than several months. Longer-term deflation is still the trend, and deflation means a strong dollar, high bond prices, and extremely low interest rates across the yield curve. So think of this bond market route as an anomaly to take advantage of in the near term, not a trend reversal back up in rates as many expect. Falling Treasury and corporate AAA bond yields still have years to run, despite most analysts and economists assuming bond yields may have bottomed in 2015. They don't see deflation coming like we do. But mark my words, the bond market is likely to get smacked temporarily before it leverages the deleveraging of the economic winter season. I'm convinced of this because of several important trends in play. 1. The bursting emerging market debt bubble. 2. The bursting emerging market currency bubble. 3. Who holds U.S. Treasuries now? 4. Continued declines in commodity prices. 5. And the warning from the T-bond channel. Let's look at each of these in more detail. The impact of the emerging market debt bubble. The global debt bubble since 2008 has been concentrated in emerging market debt, especially China. Global debt grew by $57 trillion to $199 trillion between 2008 and 2014, according to McKinsey. It's got to be well over $215 trillion or higher by now. Most of that debt occurred in emerging countries, because developed countries have already reached their peak debt capacity. Total emerging market corporate debt alone rose from $3.2 trillion in 2003 to $26 trillion in 2016. Much of that was denominated in U.S. dollar loans and bonds. This dollar-denominated foreign borrowing has risen from $2 trillion in 1995 to $10.5 trillion in 2016. That's an increase of 5.3 times. And about half of it accounts for total emerging market corporate borrowing. For some perspective, that's about half the size of the U.S. banking system and half as much as corporations have borrowed in total in the United States. Think of it this way. We now have a global U.S. dollar debt that does nothing for our economy. In late 2008, when Lehman Brothers collapsed, the Fed not only had to bail out the U.S. economy with massive QE and other measures, but it also had to extend $1 trillion in U.S. dollar swaps to provide liquidity for foreign banks dealing in U.S. dollar debt to fend off a liquidity crisis overseas. What if the next crisis, with the much higher dollar-denominated foreign debt, required as much as $2 trillion in such liquidity? Can the Fed bail out our economy and the foreign markets too? Unlikely. Congress didn't like the last foreign liquidity extension, so any new one could be blocked or stalled, especially now with a Republican Congress. This has implications for the broader global financial crisis just ahead, but there's a clear and direct threat for the issue I'm discussing here. That is, without such liquidity, foreigners, especially central banks, would be forced to sell their treasury bonds at lower and lower prices. Why only 59.8% of the treasury market is at risk. Then there's the bubble in emerging market foreign exchange holdings since 2000. FX holdings grew from $802 billion in 2001 to nearly $8.06 trillion in mid-2014. By the end of 2016, they stood at $10.79 trillion. That's more than 13 times the growth rate in 13 years. Emerging markets have taken the largest slice of the foreign holdings, growing from $0.3 trillion to $3 trillion, or a whopping 10 times. It's estimated that more than 80% of these emerging market holdings are at central banks, not with private investors. This is important because it's China and other emerging country central banks that will be the big sellers of treasuries. If we break this down further, out of $19.9 trillion of U.S. treasuries, $5.6 trillion, 27.9%, are held by Social Security and Medicare, and $2.4 trillion, 12.3%, by the Federal Reserve. The U.S. government controls 40.2% of its own treasuries. It just holds them. It doesn't trade or sell them. That means that only 59.8% are tradable. Of that, emerging market central banks are 22.7% of the market. That's substantial, especially when they herd to buy treasuries together when their currencies are rising, and then sell together when their currencies and exports are falling. The $8 trillion held by real investors makes up 40% of the $20 trillion total in U.S. public debt. Normal free market investors aren't driving this market. Early in the next financial crisis, it will be private investors and emerging market central banks selling that will create a spike in yields. Who's going to buy when the selling accelerates? Another trend that has me expecting this fixed income trade of the decade to become available by late 2017 or early 2018 is the inventory of U.S. treasuries held by brokers and dealers. As the Federal Reserve and government agencies have accumulated so much of the total stock of U.S. sovereign bonds, brokers and dealers have held less as a percentage of the bonds outstanding. After all, they need less when the Fed is dominating the market. The ratio of their inventory of bonds to the total marketable securities has fallen dramatically, from a ratio of 0.19 down to 0.04. That's a decline of 78%. This raises the question, who is going to be on the buying side when investors and emerging market central banks are selling in droves? Thus far, global private investors have picked up the slack, essentially buying what the emerging market central banks are selling. Could this continue indefinitely? Anything is possible, but I wouldn't bet on it. Emerging market selling is accelerating, and it won't take much in an illiquid market like this for supply to completely overwhelm demand from the private sector, especially if something goes wrong in the world. When there's strong selling in a less liquid market, bond prices will fall more, which will make their yields rise faster and higher than they otherwise would. But let me reiterate, this will be a shorter-term crisis, not a long-term one. This opportunity to get in on the fixed income trade of the decade is likely only a short-lived one, so you must prepare now and be ready to pounce when the time comes. Emerging countries won't be able to sell off their foreign exchange reserves forever. They'll do it only after their governments have tried the quick fixes first. But this crisis is too big to fix, and they'll have to stop selling treasuries soon enough if they don't run out of them first. There's also the fact that commodity prices have been collapsing since mid-2008. Their decline worsened in early 2011 due to China's increased slowing. At the bottom of it all, this is what's hurting the foreign exchange and emerging market debt bubbles the most. Why commodity prices will make matters worse. The commodity cycle runs very close to 30 years, and it tops like clockwork. 1920 and a double top in 1949 and 1951 are perfect examples. So are the tops in 1980 and the double top in 2008 and 2011. But the bottoms are much more varied. The last cycle peaked in 1980 and bottomed between 1998 and 2001. The current cycle peaked in June 2008, dominated by the severe crash in oil and energy. Then industrial commodities and precious metals peaked in April 2011. It's been downhill since then. Oil was down 80% at its worst point in late 2008. Iron ore and coal have been down more than 79% recently. Silver fell 70%. Even gold, the great crisis metal, has been down 45%. At this rate, the commodity cycle could easily bottom just after the next crisis, sometime in 2018 or early 2020 at the latest. But even if it doesn't, 90% or more of the damage is likely to be done by then. This continued decline will preserve downward pressure on emerging market exports, stocks, economies, and currencies. That means this vicious cycle of selling foreign exchange reserves to support currencies and stimulate economies will roll round and round until it simply can't go on any longer. On that note, if the commodities cycle does bottom in 2018, that would create a great long-term buying opportunity in both commodities and in emerging country stocks, which I'll talk about later. We won't see such an opportunity come to developed country stocks until early 2020 into late 2022. The final nail in the coffin is my T-bond channel. Watch for a potential short-term spike in rates. I've used this tool for more than a decade now. 10-year Treasury yields have traded in a channel downward since 1989. The previous cycle saw a bottom in December 2008 at 2.03%, and a top around 4% into mid-2009. But that didn't test the top of the channel. What makes this tool particularly useful is that if you buy bonds when they approach the top of this yield channel and sell them when they approach the bottom, you'll very likely score a win each time. It last tested the bottom trend line of this channel in July 2012 at 1.39%, and then first rallied to 3.04% into December 2013. Most of that was in just a matter of months. Yields went back down to 1.36% in January 2015 and appeared to be rallying upward again, with rates hitting 2.62% in late 2016. They back off to 2.12% into 2017. One more spike and we get near the top of this channel at 3.0% to 3.1%. If that occurs, that's when I will be telling my subscribers to load up on 30-year treasuries and AAA corporate bonds to play the deflation phase of debt and bubble deleveraging in the years ahead. With the storm clouds darkening over emerging markets, that makes this the high-quality fixed income buy of this decade. That would imply yields of 3.6% plus on 30-year treasuries. To take advantage, here's what I want you to do. Action to take. When the time is right, and I'll give you the green light for this one in my newsletter, buy as many 30-year treasuries as you can get your hands on, or buy AAA-rated corporate 20-year bonds. Again, I suggest the longer-term bonds because they'll benefit more from the deflationary slide with 10-year treasuries reaching 1% or a good bit lower, and 30-year treasuries reaching 1.6% or lower. You'll also get the highest yield on the 30-year bonds, 3.6% plus if the 10-year goes to near 3.1%. And they'll appreciate more when rates start falling later in 2018 and likely well into 2020 plus. So many investors cry to me about how they're depending on their high-dividend blue-chip stocks to retire and live on. My response is always the same. That's a mistake. You're going to pay a heavy price when stocks decline by as much as 80% before this crisis is over. Is it worth taking that kind of risk for a 2 to 3% dividend for the next several years? I don't think it is. And how many stocks give you a 3 to 3.6% dividend compared with the 30-year treasury? Stocks did the worst of any asset class in the Great Depression of the 1930s. Even blue chips like the Dow were off 89% at their worst point in late 1932, and they took 23 years to get back to late 1929 prices. Commodities were also down for a long time and were slow to come back. So was real estate, which lost 26% during that crisis and will be down much worse this time around. Yet, while everything was cratering and asset allocation and diversification were proving to be of little use, long-term treasury bonds and AAA corporate bonds roughly doubled in value, including interest in the 1930s. Long-term treasuries almost doubled in the wrenching decade of the 1930s, while AAA corporates a little more than doubled when you count the steady interest. If you're going to be a passive investor, make this fixed income trade of the decade. Use this likely spike into late 2017 or early 2018 to buy long-term 30-year treasuries and AAA corporate bonds. You'll get interest higher than from most stock dividends, sleep better at night again, and get some healthy capital appreciation. Of course, there's a chance I could be wrong. What then? What if, by some miracle, demand from the private sector accelerates enough to soak up all the excess supply from central bank dumping? That is the beauty of this scenario. Given how low yields are today, we're not really risking anything by staying out of 30-year treasuries for now. At current prices, the 30-year treasury yields a pathetic 2.2%. If we don't get back near the top of this T-bond channel, I'll still recommend buying 30-year treasuries and AAA corporate bonds for the more conservative side of your asset allocation in this economic winter season. Most analysts think the bond bubble and rally is over. I see it as the last to rally, because it is the only major sector favored by deflation, other than the good old U.S. dollar. Speaking of which, the dollar is the second safe haven, not gold. Gold went up in the early stages of the last crisis, with investors expecting money printing to follow. But what happened instead was the meltdown of our financial institutions. When such deflationary trends set in, much like in the early 1930s, gold collapsed. It lost 33%, and silver lost 50%. But guess what spiked up in that crisis? You got it, the U.S. dollar. It rose 27%. It was the other safe haven, along with the highest quality bonds and cash. The dollar had seen a massive fall versus our key trading partners since 1985. It was devalued by our issuing so much domestic and foreign debt. But that debt faces massive restructuring in the crisis ahead. Fewer dollars means they're worth more. The dollar literally bottomed longer term at 71 in January 2008, right when the Great Recession started. It's been up to as high as 104 in 2017, a 46% gain. Is that a safe haven or what? I see the dollar going back to its high of 120, maybe higher. Once there, it'll be back to fair value. But at levels as low as 97 and potentially as low as 92 in 2017, it's a bargain, and another safe haven sector to put money into. UUP, the PowerShares DB U.S. Dollar Index Bullish Fund, is the easiest way to bet on the dollar going up, or you can find a good dollar bull fund. Playing a bear market. When playing a bear market, the same rules hold. You want to diversify your risks, especially knowing that collapses move even faster than rallies. You need to decide how much safe cash or near cash you want to hold to sleep at night and to handle financial emergencies, like the loss of your job or your house. Then decide how much to put into longer-term high-quality bonds, like those 30-year treasuries and AAA corporates. But I think it's still premature to make this move at the time of this writing, in August 2017. Then decide how much you want to put into a dollar bull fund or the ETF UUP, which tracks the U.S. dollar versus its six major trading partners. If you're willing to risk part of your wealth, you can also bet on financial assets going down, from stocks to gold. Stocks are the one type of financial asset that goes down in either a deflationary crisis like the 1930s or an inflationary one like the 1970s. So shorting stocks is the best way to prosper in the downturn, either way. But don't leverage this bet. The markets are simply too volatile. You can short the stock market with no leverage by simply buying an ETF, exchange-traded fund, like the ProShares Short S&P 500, ticker SH. It's an inverse fund on the S&P 500, so if the index goes down 50%, you make 50%. The ProShares Ultra Short, ticker QID, is double short the NASDAQ 100, which is likely to get hit the worst. If you make this play, just do a half share to avoid that 2x leverage. Hold the other half in cash or short-term bonds. Direxion Daily's small cap bear 3x ETF, ticker TZA, is triple short the Russell 2000, which is also likely to lead on the way down. So buy only a 1/3 share of this one to remain without leverage. That means the money you allocate here should be 1/3 in TZA and 2/3 in cash to offset the leverage. And unlike the gold bugs, I see gold collapsing. It's an inflation hedge, not a deflation hedge. If gold rallies back as high as $1,425 on my predicted bear market rally, then it could easily drop to around $700 within a year. Your last decision is whether to risk some of your funds betting on gold's downside for the greatest potential returns. You can buy DB Gold Double Short ETN, ticker DZZ, Double Short Gold, at a half share to offset the leverage, or just simply short GLD, the ETF that follows gold. There you have it, how to handle the coming crash. Next up, let's get you into position for the opportunities ahead so that you're ready when we start to come out the other side, with emerging markets and commodities likely leading the charge. Chapter 16. The Emerging World Boomers. It's not as simple as buying an emerging market fund or an ETF like EEM, iShares MSCI Emerging Markets. That would be a good strategy, but it's not the best one. Harry Dent. My demographic research makes it crystal clear that emerging countries, outside of China and a few others like Thailand, will dominate demographic growth in the next global boom. But the even more powerful factor is the urbanization process, with the typical emerging country only 50% urbanized, as compared with 85% in the typical developed country. In emerging countries, urbanization increases household income as much as 3x from its level in rural areas. As people move into the cities, they also climb the social and economic ladder into the middle class. With the cycle swirling around us for the next several years and the force of revolution reshaping our world, emerging markets are in the best position to come booming out the other side. That's why investors and businesses should be investing more in emerging countries when this crash likely sees its worst, by early 2020. My research is unique when it comes to projecting urbanization, GDP per capita gains from it, and demographic workforce growth trends and peaks in emerging countries. It's not what I'm most known for, but it's the most strategic factor in the next global boom, which emerging countries will dominate. As a general guideline, those in South and Southeast Asia, from the Philippines to India and Pakistan, have strong demographic growth, urbanization trends, and productivity gains ahead. This is not the case for China, though. Latin America has mostly strong demographic growth, but limited continued urbanization and productivity gains. Much of the Middle East and Africa have not joined the Democratic Capitalism Party, but those regions otherwise have the most extreme urbanization and demographic potential. One day they'll be the best places to invest, but not yet. So let's look at who the next boomers will be. Indonesia. It doesn't get clearer than this. Indonesia is my favorite example of a good, solid emerging country that is urbanizing at high and predictable rates with consistent GDP per capita gains over time. Most emerging countries, including Indonesia, have a linear progression of GDP per capita for every 1% they gain in their urbanization rate. That was one of my great breakthroughs in my research about a decade ago. They eventually top out between 80 and 90% urban. The world today is 52% urban and rising. This is the most powerful driver of GDP growth, as urban workers have access to a much broader array of jobs and can specialize much more. This is what drives productivity. More than just aging into peak spending and income ages, especially because emerging countries don't have as steep a rise in income and spending by age as developed countries do. They don't have as high a proportion of professional, managerial, and technical jobs that accelerate income growth. Construction and agricultural workers don't make that much more as they age. The country is 54% urban, 2% above the global average. It's been urbanizing at a consistent rate, on average of 0.92% gains annually since 1985, a faster rate than in any emerging country in Asia except China. That means that over a decade, it will add 9.2% of its population to urban areas until the process peaks. At that rate, it'll take the country about 38 years to become 90% urban. That's where it'll likely peak around 2055. That's almost four decades of productivity gains.